Great way to keep that fire of divine love going in your heart. God bless you, friends.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Delighted to have back with me. It's been a year since Brother Elias Marshall from the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Conyers, Georgia, Trappist, is back with me. We talked at that time about his book, which was then recently published, Tears of an Innocent God, and I promised I wanted to have him back on because he's a fascinating guy. We had a great conversation, and I wanted to talk more. Before he comes on, I want to mention that he has another book. It was published earlier, called Dancing Madly Backwards, A Journey into God. So welcome to the show, Brother Elias.
Great to be on. Thank you for asking me.
You're a great voice, and belies your age, but I won't reveal what it is.
You can tell them.
80.
80.
Wow. Tell my audience what you just told me on the air about the impact of contemplation on aging.
If you've done, let's say, non-objectless meditation, without an object of perception, and gone beneath the level of thoughts and feelings and images and so forth for a lengthy time, then your biological age, according to studies, is reduced by, in other words, I'm 80, so I might be 65 or something like that.
Well, you have a remarkably young voice. Not that I do, in fact, notice that voices change with age, and sounds like yours kind of got stuck around 50. But I want to begin with this question. As I read your book and some of your comments that I found on the internet, your interviews, what exactly is inner silence?
Inner silence. You know, you might call it pure awareness. If you notice that when you're thinking, there you never have sentences back to back. There's always a gap in between a sentence or a series of sentences, right? And if you notice that gap, there's no object of awareness. In other words, there's no thought as an object of awareness. And that awareness is stillness or silence. Does that make any sense?
Well, I was trying to, silence, of course, is an auditory metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
It's about hearing. But obviously, you mean more than that.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of what the visual metaphor would be for inner silence, inner blindness.
No.
Because silence is the lack of any sound. So I was thinking, is inner silence the lack of any sight?
No.
It's the problem of the via negativa.
It's a dynamic phenomenon. Silence is not speaking or anything like that, but it's very dynamic. And it's awareness without any perception. And there's a sense of vastness with it. And it's being as opposed to doing. So, you know, our culture has this, paradigm that I am what I do and what other people think of me. So that insinuates itself in prayer. So people often, at least in the Christian tradition, think of prayer as doing something, like thinking about God or praying to God or this and that and the other, and making God an object of perception, you see. But this is not doing, it's simply being with God, or being from inside God, whatever you want to look at it.
No, but I want to kind of just challenge you there, because coming from a philosophical background like I do,
yeah,
and you're being a Marischal after all, and for our audience doesn't know what the joke was, there's a very famous Neo-Thomist philosopher at the turn of the century named Marischal from Louvain. I couldn't agree more with you when you talk about this paradigm of I am what I do, and I judge myself as others judge me by what I do or what I don't do or attain. But when you talk about inner silence as dynamic and without perception, I get a little lost there. Because I think of, I mean, I get the image of closing your eyes and clearing your mind and letting just things come to you.
No, that's fine. It just, as you grow through, I've been on this road for 45 to 50 years, starting when I was in Europe, island of Mallorca, and then in the Alps, meditating all day long. And what happens is the more you meditate or pray deeply, then less and less are you inclined to be jammed with thoughts or perceptions, objects of perceptions and so on. But you think clearly, but there is a dynamic silence that is underlying it all. And that we're born with that. We have an interior spaciousness from the moment we're born, and it's a part of the image of God. The image of God consists of characteristics such as kindness, compassion, reverent listening, and dynamic silence, spaciousness, vastness. And so this just unfolds more and more and more through the years. And then you reach a point, for example, I've been speaking with you for a little while, I haven't had a single thought come to my mind.
That makes me a lousy host.
No, but in other words, I'm not thinking about, you know, what am I going to tell him or anything like that.
No.
It's just simply I'm speaking out of a certain immensity or vastness or silence. And it's really hard to describe. It's the silence or the awareness is in the foreground when I'm not speaking with someone. Or working in the bakery, like I was this morning, making fudge. Or it can go to, so it goes to the background when you're speaking with someone and working on fudge and so on. Background. And then when you leave that, then the silence comes to the foreground. And,
now are you?
So it's a wonderful thing. Really, because, you know, there's not I don't have all these thoughts coming and going and running here and running there or anything, but inner stillness is another, probably the better word to use. Inner stillness. And that is, if you go to the ancient monastic tradition, they say stillness is what it's all about. Because when you have the stillness, you're one with the stillness of God. And then you're not, you know, opposed to one another or anything like that.
You know? But you call it
Christ, for example. Christ said, "The Father and I are one," and that's the non-dual, absolute same oneness.
Okay? Monism.
Oneness, living oneness. But later on, he says, "Father, if you will, let this chalice pass from me." That's dual. But he doesn't lose the oneness as he does as he speaks to the Father. You see what I'm saying?
I do, and I don't. I do and I don't. And this is the part of don't. Stillness and dynamism don't go together for me. How is it dynamic if it's a stillness?
Well, you have to experience it, the subtle energy.
Oh, come on. I mean, can't you try to explain it?
You can't explain. It's like trying to explain a blind person trying to describe an apple or something.
Or describe sight.
You have to experience it.
Let me explore that.
Let me put it this way.
Okay.
If you sit in a chair and you're perfectly still in body, that will lead to stillness of the mind. So that's what people ought to try to do. You know, stillness of the body gives rise to stillness of the mind. Stillness of the mind gives rise to stillness of the body. And mind and body go hand in hand. One goes up, another one goes up too, thinking and so forth.
Wouldn't you say that just about everything in contemporary life mitigates against this experience?
Yeah, it does.
There's almost nothing that encourages it, or am I wrong about that?
Absolutely nothing, and that's why we're having very few people knock at our doors at the monastery, because it's all doing, you know, do, then they'll come to you and you say, what are you doing? Well, you're making fruitcake? Fudge? No, we're doing a lot more. And they can't understand how vastness or silence or stillness make any sense whatsoever, because like young people are now on the fast lane and going faster and faster and faster. And if they are a Catholic and they're interested in a religious order, they wouldn't pick us because they wouldn't be able to see the fruits of their doing. So they tend to gravitate toward an active order like the Dominicans or the Jesuits or something they teach in a university or work in a parish and ministry and so forth and so on. So,
hasn't that always been the case that given all things being equal, most people choose the active contemplative life?
Yeah, they do. And you know, all of this conviction that I am what I do goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. And it's been part of the paradigm of Western mentality.
Well, Aristotle said happiness was an action.
Yeah. And in Sparta, you know, when you come to a social consensus, which means a tribe or a nation or a community or something, it takes a long time to come to a certain conclusion. But once that conclusion is made, then you don't question it. And if you question it that, you know, hard enough, then it will kill you, actually. Like they did Jesus and Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. So in Sparta, the idea was, if a man is no longer productive, it was understood that he would just simply take a blanket, go to the hills, and die. And so Sparta was, you know, there were corpses all over the place, you know, because of this. And that has endured through the centuries in the West. It has.
Brother Marshall, I want to remind our listeners that the name of your book is Tears of an Innocent God, and it's a wonderful book, and I recommend everybody take a look at it. If you look around the internet at reviews of it, nearly everyone calls it a transformative book, a book in the tradition of Thomas Merton. And by the way, how much have you been influenced by Thomas Merton?
Oh, very much. Seven Story Mountain was what got me moving.
And as a young man?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I was reading Thomas Merton toward the end of college, okay? Then I went to Fort Knox for a six-month special program for college students. Okay, and Fort Knox was very near to Gethsemane. And so I was drawn to go to, on leave to go to Gethsemane because of this incredible book, which just captivated me 100%, mind, body, spirit, heart, everything. And so I made a reservation to go to Gethsemane, which was like, you could, when you're at Gethsemane, you can actually hear the artillery going off in Fort Knox.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, from a very, very great distance, faintly. But when I went there, when I walked into the courtyard, I was absolutely floored and absolutely blown away by the silence. The silence was so deep and piercing, and it was unbelievable. I just couldn't imagine it.
And did you meet Merton?
No, unfortunately, Father Lewis, we called him, his name was Father Lewis, had died about, he was still alive when I went to Gethsemane the first time. But subsequently, I was a member of Gethsemane in the 70s and had to leave because of restless leg syndrome. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No, I haven't.
That's a killer. It doesn't allow you to sleep very well.
Then you've had it all your life?
Oh, yeah.
How do you get your rest?
It was recently, 10 years ago, by a neurologist. And I'd always gone to a GP, and they didn't know what it was. So, but anyway, get back to Gethsemane. Then I went in, and that day, they had had a feast day with incense, and the place was pervaded by this incredibly wonderful scent of incense, you know. And then I went up to the balcony where they were chanting Vespers in Gregorian, in Latin, and that blew me away completely because the sound value of Latin is very powerful. As a matter of fact, in India they call it the religion of sound because you can be listening to the Vedas chanted, and that's pre- Hinduism, by the way, and they can be chanted, but the sound vibrations are so powerful they go beneath your level of everything, thoughts, images, everything. And so the sound of Gregorian chant has this quality of vibration that's incredibly deep, and that really blew me away. And then getting to meet a few of the monks just blew me away. So,
by the way, I had the same experience at your monastery back in the years before I became a Catholic at age 35.
Oh.
My friend Erasmo Leyva, who had been a novice there, took me over several times, and I had my first confession there. And I can completely identify with the impact your visit to Gethsemane had, because I had the same impact going to the Monastery of the Holy Spirit, although Erasmo did make me sit in the choir and try to sing along. And everybody looked at Erasmo because he was singing too loud. Evidently, he did that as a novice also.
You know, he's in Europe now with the staff of the general.
I know, yes.
You knew that?
Yeah. He's Father Simon now.
Yeah, Simeon.
Simeon, yes. We had a nice reunion a few years ago. He got to meet my son, whom he had never met.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And he's a wonderful person.
He's quite something. But getting back to the train of thought of your book, Tears of an Innocent God, I get the sense that we meet God within ourselves when we succeed in this stillness. And by the way, you distinguish between two types of contemplation.
Yeah.
One is a kind of active contemplation, but the other is kind of
infused,
intuitive, sudden infusion.
Yeah. So, as I say in the book, when I was a freshman at Notre Dame in South Bend,
Right.
There was, you know, we had freshman orientation. And a priest, a Sacred Heart priest, told us about this grotto. And he said, you guys have to go there. He said, I've got to go there. So we didn't know even what a grotto was. And we said, what's a grotto? He said, well, it's modeled on Lourdes, the Grotto of Lourdes. We said, well, what's that all about? Well, that's where a lot of miracles take place. So in the first few weeks, I took it into my head to go down to the grotto. So I went down there toward evening and walked when the birds had stopped chirping and everything was very quiet and settled. And I expected, actually, to find some tourists there because Notre Dame is flooded with tourists all the time. So I went down there, and guess what? No tourists and nobody except one person. And he was the starting tackle of the Notre Dame football team.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really, wow, you know, because at Notre Dame, you just, in those days, you really looked up to the football players. And so he was absolutely still, eyes closed, absolutely still. And I said, man, I got to go next to him. So I knelt next to him. And then after a while, with my eyes closed, all of a sudden, it was as though if I wanted to speak, I could not. In other words, my tongue was so heavy. So my senses were bound at that moment. And then that was followed by a sudden sinking down into, I don't know what, but I opened my eyes 20, 22 minutes later, and it seemed like 1 second.
Wow.
So I was in infinity. And that's what's called infused contemplation, where God just simply, bang, intervenes in your life and takes you deep into infinity. Okay. The second kind is acquired contemplation, which means a person can go, let's say, to a chapel and be quiet and, you know, ponder scripture and all this sort of thing. And that leads to quietness. And that's what we call acquired contemplation, because you prepare yourself for it. You're doing something. The other one is suddenly out of nowhere. Okay.
How much later was it that you entered the monastery?
Oh, let me see. From Notre Dame?
Yeah, well, from the visit to Gethsemane.
No, what happened was I went to, I graduated from college and then went to Gethsemane, yeah. And then I didn't think of entering Gethsemane at the time. And at the time, if you were a Catholic and you wanted to be holy, you had to be a priest. So the pastor said to me, when are you going to get to seminary? You know, what are you waiting for? Take the bull by the horn. And so I just very docilely did. And I, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. But as time went on, I was, this same experience of infused contemplation was with me all the time, all the way through the seminary. And then I got into my third year, and the end of my second year, I started really being pulled to the monastery. And I was a seminarian for the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., and they sent me to this seminary up north. And finally, I told them, you know, I have to leave. I have to leave the seminary to pursue this. So I started making visits to our monastery in Berryville, Virginia, in the Shenandoahs.
Yeah, and beautiful place.
It is an incredibly beautiful place. I mean, stunning, with the, you know, Shenandoah and everything, you know. And I was just captivated by that. And so rather than go to Gethsemane, this was in my backyard because I was living in Washington, D.C. area. Maryland, suburban Maryland. And so I entered there. And
how old were you?
24, maybe. my God.
And it's been smooth sailing ever since?
No. Well, you see, I had restless leg syndrome when I went into the monastery.
Oh.
And what that means is you have like 20, 50, 100 leg movements per night. And that takes you away from the deepest level of sleep over and over and over again. So you don't get much sleep. So it was really, really hard because we had a lot of work to do during the day, and orchard grass in the morning, hay in the hay fields in the afternoon, and so on. And it was really something, but I loved the life very, very, very much. And that's when I really fell in love with it. But as it went along, it seemed like I was just struggling so much because of the lack of sleep. And so I told my novice master and my abbot that I was leaving. The abbot wanted me to stay and sleep in and this sort of thing. So I called my parents, and my father came out to pick me up in a convertible, and we went. I couldn't say a word the whole time. We stopped next to a bunch of teenagers with this rock music and everything. I thought it was going to be crazy. And so when I got to my parents' house, they had a party waiting for me. And I said, just show me a bed. That's all I want.
Hmm.
So I slept for 19 to 20 hours straight, bolted up out of bed, and I said, my God, what have I done?
Hold on at that point in the story, because we're going to take a short break. I'm with Brother Elias Marshall from the Trappist Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Conyers, Georgia. Wonderful place. I had my first confession there. And we'll be back after this brief message.
Hello, this is Dan Dimite.
And Patrick Rice, and we are the co-hosts of Encounter Radio, the show that brings you the life-changing encounters of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission.
Encounter Radio is a show where the supernatural becomes natural and where you are encouraged and equipped to live out your calling every day in boldness and power.
You can now hear Encounter Radio on this Ave Maria station every Sunday at 2 p.m. That's every Sunday at 2 p.m. and online at encounterradio.org.
What do you think is one of the fastest growing ministries in the Catholic Church today? Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews when my guest, Catherine Wiley, founder of the ministry, will surprise you with the answer and challenge you to become involved. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
What's the path to true happiness? Turns out our bodies can answer that question better than we can. A recent study by UCLA and the University of North Carolina found that people who pursued happiness primarily through pleasure produced fewer disease-fighting antibodies and experienced more joint swelling than people who pursued happiness by being loving and trying to lead meaningful lives. Although both groups claimed to be equally happy, researchers found that only the participants who worked hard to be loving, virtuous people were happy all the way down to the cellular level. Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body tells us that we can know God's intention for our lives and relationships by reflecting on the design of our bodies. Science and faith agree. The path to true bone-deep happiness is to love your neighbor and to live virtuously. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I'm back with Brother Elias Marshall from the Monastery of the Holy Spirit. We've been talking about his book, Tears of an Innocent God, which I strongly recommend. Brother, a lot of people blame this lack of contemplative urge that you described about fewer people coming out to Conyers Monastery to the huge popularity of social media. What is your view of that impact of social media?
Well, it's part of the culture. It's a segment of the whole show, you know, going 100 miles an hour down the fast lane. And And, you could be really terribly distracted and pulled in every direction. But when your mind is quiet, and I think the news, for example, is very important to me now because we're in a very divided country, and I just need to make sure what's going on so I can pray for all of this stuff. And so I think it's, in my own experience, it's a tremendously good thing, the social media.
Because it does unify a great deal.
Yeah.
And it does help people who are in lonely situations to have contact with other people.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And for example, YouTube has wonderful spiritual conferences by people like Thomas Keating and so on. Martin Luther.
And you?
Well, yeah. And so we're very blessed to have all of that on YouTube. People think sometimes that YouTube is not very good, but I mean, it depends on what you look at.
Imagine if they had had YouTube in the Middle Ages.
Virtual music and all kinds of things. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Imagine if we had YouTube in the Middle Ages. What a treasure trove we would have right now. You talk about how divided we are. I'm 67. I've never seen our country so divided, and I lived through, race riots and integration in Texas and Vietnam and so forth. What's behind it?
Well, you mean the division?
Yes.
Well, I'm not supposed to be political, but I'll say the Trump administration and all its policies of the.
So you're a critic of the Trump administration?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Okay. Well, everybody on this channel knows that I strongly supported him and do support him, but doesn't mean we can't have a civil conversation about it.
No, of
and
course.
But what about the the violence and the burning and the barring of people from speaking in colleges and universities? Surely that's unnecessary, isn't it?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And are you in a position to understand how it's gotten that bad?
Not really, because I'm in this place, So all I get is from the media and from friends. I have outside friends, From
are they that angry with that Trump was elected?
No. They're very concerned. I'm concerned. I guess that's the best word.
I mean, feel free to express your concern.
24 million people are going to be.
What is your concern? What is your concern?
Well, I'm afraid that all the social programs are being cut. NIH, research is being cut off. That means cancer research and all those things like that. And all these programs are just being cut in to favor the military thing. And, industries and so on. And, with the Trump care, as they call it now, 24 million people could be cut off from health care.
He's promised that won't happen.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not contained in this. All they say is that health care is accessible, but that's different from being covered. But we really shouldn't be talking about this.
I would say, we should. I mean, it's rare that people in this moment in time can actually talk and still, get along and have different. I mean, let's face it. Right now, we're a model of you and I are a model of the discourse that's totally missing in America right now.
I truly respect your position, and I honor it, and I just happen to.
Yeah, but I'll make a prediction which I would stand behind.
Okay,
that these 24 million people you're talking about will never lose medical coverage.
Okay, well I'm afraid it
just won't happen.
Okay,
and the cutting of some other things, some research programs, the cutting of some other things is going to happen because, in my opinion, that. There's been no oversight, especially the research monies that have gone to universities. Universities have never, and that by law, need to account for the spending of that money. They've never done it. So I think there's some...
NIH is a different story, you know.
Well, a lot of... Yeah, NIH is very, very important. Very important.
And that bothers me because it cuts off a lot of money from very significant at the National Institute of Health.
I will personally look into that. Okay? I'll look into that. I have some friends inside the White House, and I'll be in there next week, as a matter of fact. So
really,
but I'll look into it.
I think that's great. Because the more Trump people who can be, want the good of the people, the better.
Well, I think there's a lot of goodwill there that people are missing. I think that President Trump is to some degree responsible because of the tone of his campaign, but I think it's clear that he's become more presidential in style in the first 100 days, and certainly his attitude toward Mexico and Canada have rounded out into much more on much more friendly terms over, about NAFTA and so forth. But,
well, listen, I'm 100% behind him, I really am. And I pray that the Spirit will guide him.
I'll share this with you because I just happen to be in a position to know. He's come a long way spiritually.
Good.
And this journey began not with the campaign, but some years ago. But during the campaign, I mean, he was constantly learning things about faith, religion, Christianity in particular, that, resonated with him, and which he has, as Bernard Lonergan would say, reappropriated in his own life. And he's nobody's saint for sure, and he's not going to be anybody's saint. But I think when you're called to an office like that is that important, I think any person of goodwill is going to grow a great deal very quickly.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Absolutely.
You've got to grow. You've got too much responsibility.
Yeah, again, if the good of the people is served, then I'm all for whatever he does, okay?
Now, going back to the thread of contemplation.
I hope your listeners, by the way, by saying...
What is it?
I hope I have not lost your listeners.
Oh, no. My listeners are very diverse, and they're probably annoyed at me for being so much for Trump. They're probably cheering you on as we speak.
We're able to respect each other,
Yeah, I mean, believe me, my listeners are, thankfully they know that I'm primarily a beauty and truth guy.
Mm-hmm.
And not political guy. I just sort of happened to accidentally get involved in that.
Well, put all your positivity into it. We need it, really.
Yeah.
And anything you can do to influence for the good, for the common good.
Well, I was...
Would be the work of God in you.
I was remembering today because someone sent me a film I made in the early 90s about Jacques Maritain.
Oh, Maritain, yeah.
And I was reminded of how much reading Maritain did to me. Of course, Maritain and Merton were very close friends. Did you know that?
Yeah.
And, in fact, there's a book out about their last meeting at Gethsemane. Maritain visited Gethsemane along with John Howard Griffin.
Oh, John Howard Griffin. He visited here, too,
Yeah. They came together, and they sat with Merton.
Mm-hmm.
And Merton played records by Bob Dylan.
Show him my ass, too.
And there's pictures of all this, but Maritain, the way he handles the contemplative life in the midst of the degrees of knowledge and intuitivity, because he believed in knowledge of God by intuition.
Yeah.
He was very criticized for that as a Thomist because, Thomists are always supposed to have concepts. Govern everything, right?
Everything.
But if you read the Degrees of Knowledge, his greatest work, at the very end of the book is a long treatise on St. John of the Cross.
Mm, yeah.
In other words, all knowledge culminates in mystical vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. You have to have theory and practice. One enlivens the other, you know? But by the way, Maritain, I'm very grateful to him because he introduced me to Elie Wiesel.
How did that happen?
Well, did you know about that? Did you ever read the book Night?
Yes, it's one of the hardest books I've ever read.
I think that, yeah.
His memoir, yes.
But the preface, or whatever it is, the opening introduction, talks about Elie Wiesel, who I've just admired and loved so much over the years.
Did you love Maritain?
No, I've loved Elie Wiesel.
Well, he wrote the book Night.
Yes, but what happened was he was a young man who worked for a Paris newspaper, and he went to interview Maritain.
Oh, I never knew this. Tell me.
No.
How did I miss this? I was president of the American Maritain Association for years.
Oh, this is really important.
Yeah.
So, Wiesel had been Auschwitz, you know, since
yes.
he was a teenager.
Yes.
Okay. And this experience was so devastating that he took an oath never to talk about it, ever, ever, ever. So he went to talk with Maritain, and somehow Maritain started talking about Christianity and how wonderful it was and how much Christ suffered and this and that and the other. And all of a sudden, something went off in Wiesel, something snapped. And he said, I know of many, many people who suffer as much as your Christ. And he started to open up about his experience at Auschwitz. And Maritain was just stunned. And so Wiesel got up and he says, all right, I'm leaving. So he went to the elevator and he started punching the elevator button. And all of a sudden the introduction says, then this old man, Jacques Maritain, came up behind him and with tears just streaming down his cheeks, he said, please, please come back. Please come back. So he went back. He went back. And Maritain said, you have to write about this. You must write about this. And so, guess what?
La Nuit.
Huh?
La Nuit.
Yeah.
Night.
Maritain wrote the introduction to the book.
Gosh, you know, when I read Night, which was back in college,
yeah,
I didn't know Jacques Maritain was, so I would have missed that.
Well, isn't that incredible?
Oh, but I'm so grateful for you telling me that. I don't know how I missed it. but I'm so glad to know because, you know, Maritain was, as you know, a French Catholic convert.
That's right.
In the 20s, and he took on the anti-Semitism left over from the Dreyfus Affair.
Mm-hmm.
And he met, you know, he married a Jewish Russian who had come after the revolution, Raisa. Oh. And they both converted under the influence of Léon Bois,
oh.
who was also a French Catholic who had taken on anti-Semitism,
oh.
which was, at that time, virulent in France. It was almost a state principle, and I'm really, really glad you told that story because it fits right into who Maritain was in terms of his view of the Jews and their spiritual importance in history.
Well, if it hadn't been for him, we don't know if Wiesel had ever write, you know.
But
it was such a powerful experience for Wiesel and Maritain both that he finally said, okay, yeah, I'll write.
I'm going to be writing an article about that, and I'll thank you for it.
Good.
But what does that tell you about human encounter? I mean, what does that tell you about... I mean, did Wiesel walk into that office expecting that his life would change?
No, of course not. It's providence. Whether you're a Jew or a Christian, providence doesn't know any religion, you know. It just cuts through everything. And all cultures, religions, and everything. And God is in everything and inspiring everything, moving forward in everything. And I think that the Spirit of Jesus brought those two people together. And that,
Speaking of people being brought together, I read an article about you going over to Athens and speaking at a evangelical church.
Oh, yeah.
And you were surprised by how much fun you had, how well you received.
Oh, it was great. The pastor is a young man who went through my novitiate here, and I transmitted to him everything about the contemplative life and experience and theory. So, and when he left here, he went to Athens with nobody, you know, and he started transmitting what I had transmitted to him, and it built up to 400 students now.
Wow.
And he asked me to come. I'm the godfather for his child, okay? And so he asked me to come and speak, and that's one everybody should listen to, actually, because it's this dialogue between him and me.
And yeah, I see that that's available on the Internet.
Yeah, it is. And I think everybody should listen to that.
What should they Google to get to that?
Athens, Grace Athens.
And then Brother Elias Marichal. It's fairly easy to find because I came across it today myself.
Okay. But anyway, that was a huge moment for me, you know, with those 400 students. And something shifted in me for the good. I was so overpowered by the faith that was displayed and the energy that was coming out of these young people. It was just unbelievable.
And have you ever
really touched my soul at a very deep level?
Have you ever encountered that among Catholic college students?
No.
The one place I have is at the Franciscan University of Steubenville.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That's the one place I've encountered it.
Uh-huh.
And it's really very powerful. You know, I'm an ex-Southern Baptist minister.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I walked through the aisle of a Southern Baptist church and got dunked. And I actually have a tape of the first sermon I ever preached.
Oh, really?
And it's just so embarrassing. I talk about love, 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 acceptance.
Oh,
it's just awful. But, but you know, it's where I was at the time.
Yeah. But it goes to show you that, you know, a lot of people put down the young people. But you can't do that. You can't generalize because these 400 kids were just beautiful, and they come out to see me, by the way.
Good.
And I maintain contact and everything. And I'm still giving spiritual direction to the former novice who's a minister there by phone, every 2 weeks or something like that.
You know, when I was...
And he's coming out on Monday with some of the kids, some of the young kids.
I should have him on the show.
You should.
Yeah, why don't you send me his email?
He started the house churches on the Athens campus, and that was students who would take over an old frat house and turn it into a house church. I've seen miracles. Like this one kid from there, John brought him out. John Raymond is his name. He brought him to me, and this young man said that he had been addicted to sex, drugs, alcohol, and on and on. And he said that one day, you know, he joined the house church, and suddenly, after a time there, he woke up and he was completely healed of all of these addictions. They just went bang in one swell soup, or what do you call it? And that was a miracle. And then I saw another young man from University of Georgia. The same thing happened to him. And he's just completely free of all addictions now.
Well, there's a lot of that going around.
Hmm?
There's a lot of that going around that needs to be confronted.
Uh-huh.
And these, you know, we have addictions to drugs, to, you know, alcohol, to sex, to porn. What is it that frees somebody from an addiction, brother?
I don't know, but this was instantaneous, just as my infused contemplation was instantaneous. And I know that it's carried them because I've seen them since then, and they've been free from it. Free. The Lord just, it's a miracle. It is a miracle. And you should see these guys. They're just really outstanding. But that's a miracle, and I was, wow, good Lord, this is really something. You know.
What is
John Raymond, the pastor there. He's a young guy.
I want to get in touch, but we have 4 minutes left, and I want to ask you this question.
Sure.
One thing I've dealt with personally and in my family and in the lives of many friends is that people get banged up in life. They really get hurt and they really go through a bad time, and it seems to mark them for the rest of their life. It seems to never go away in their mind, you know, in their thoughts and so forth. What would you recommend for people who feel they're, you know, sort of hung on that hook and they can't get off?
Well, that's trauma. Trauma, which cannot be erased from the brain. That's what the modern research says. And so you have to work with this. And psychotherapy is certainly a good thing if you find the right one. And certainly your faith and your faith community and deep prayer.
How much does the inner silence help with this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the quieter you are on the inside, the more these things are, let go.
I mean, have you had experience and regrets that you can never sort of erase from your mind?
Experiences that can erase?
Mm-hmm.
No, I have memory, and they're still there. And then something will jump out.
Do they weigh on you?
No, not at all.
Well, that's remarkable.
No.
That you have not yet. You have nothing weighing you down that way.
No, nothing's weighing me down because I've made peace with all this. I was abused as a child, you know.
Oh Lord, I didn't know that.
Yeah, big time. And I just have, come to peace with my abuser and so forth. And part of the family was part of the problem. But I just see it as, okay, this is grist for the mill. And as I've gone along, I've been able to forgive and ask for forgiveness for what I have done to others. And you just, you just keep expanding. You know, Meister Eckhart said that sanctity isn't a matter of adding anything, it's subtracting everything. Subtracting everything that stands in the way of the unfolding of the divine image. So,
where do you start reading Meister Eckhart?
Not really.
Where do you start reading
him?
What's his best book to read?
Gee, I don't know. I don't know.
I remember you struck a nerve because I remember reading him in Protestant Seminary at Princeton and absolutely loved him.
Yeah. Well, he was condemned, I think, by the church.
All the good people were condemned.
Yeah. Understand,
Well, look at what a rough time Thomas Merton got.
Oh, yeah.
So unfair.
Very much so. Where everything snapped in terms of contemplative experience and so on was with the plague. Because there were people who were experiencing contemplative up to the plague, and then something, they just completely destroyed. And after the plague, every religious order in Catholicism patterned itself, including the Trappists, on the Jesuit model of Lectio Divina, which is praying of the scriptures. And you have four stages of that Lectio Orantia: reading, reflection, prayer, and contemplation. And they stopped at the first two. So everyone was just thinking about God and not experiencing God very directly. And that was where everything got kind of messed up.
And that's why your book can be very important to people. It's called Tears of an Innocent God by Brother Elias Marichal. And I want you to know that, Brother, we're going to be replaying our original interview to pair with this one so that people can hear both those conversations.
Oh, good.
So thanks for being my guest again on Church and Culture.
People respect you, and I'm so grateful for you for having me on the show.
Well, feeling is the same. And all of you who are listening, please come back. We're going to have another conversation with Brother Elias.
When a high-spirited, red-headed orphan girl is sent to live with the Cuthberts, they claim a mistake has been made. They wanted a boy. But before no-nonsense Marilla and her quiet brother can send her back, Anne's winsome ways capture their hearts, and her winning personality and ridiculous antics captivate all who come to know her. Come see Anne of Green Gables, presented by Christ the King Homeschoolers Co-op at Whitmore Lake Secondary School, April 27th through the 29th. The whole family will enjoy this heartwarming tale. Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, Gainsley Electric in Ypsilanti, serving Southeast Michigan for more than 30 years. Specialists in commercial, institutional, and residential electrical wiring and generators. For information, call 734-434-9087. That number again, 734-434-9087. On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Don't worry, be faithful. Gary Zimick joins us on a Monday to talk about how to worry less and pray more. Plus, Gail Buckley with our scripture verse of the week.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO. Right to Life of North Macomb is hosting its fifth annual dinner event at the elegant Palazzo Grand in Shelby Township, Tuesday, May 2nd, featuring Ed Rivett of Right to Life of Michigan and the renowned priest, Father Ben Lucke. For tickets, call 313-296-1770. That's 313-296-1770. Or at the web at www.lifeisapeach.org.
On our Pro-Life miniseries on Putting on the Mind of Christ this week, we feature medical doctor and teen sex educator Dr. Meg Meeker.
But this is what I found, that at that time, and that was in the early 21st century, like 2000, 2001, 15 million Americans every year got a new sexually transmitted infection. A new one. Not just carried over from the year before, but a new one. And here's the thing that really upset me. Two-thirds of those people are under 25. So there was a disproportionate concentration of infections amongst our youth.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. On a recent Friday evening in the Fellowship Hall at Our Lady of Good Counsel Church in Plymouth, Michigan, teen sex educator Dr. Meg Meeker spoke to a packed house. There were educators, there were parents, and there were teens all in attendance. They learned what Hollywood, the media, and the medical industry don't want you to know about teen sex. Hear it for yourself. Join us for Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
The faculty and staff of Father Gabriel Richard High School congratulate the graduating class of 2017. It was an honor and privilege to serve you, teach you, and learn from you. As you move forward, remember these words of St. John Paul II. The future is in your hearts. And in your hands, God is entrusting to you the task, at once difficult and uplifting, of working with Him in the building of the civilization of love.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is it really possible to discipline your children without getting angry? I'm Dr. Ray. Well, yes. And well, no. What's one of the easiest ways to be calm when you discipline? Act early.